This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Spindlefire by Lexa Hillier, performed by Fiona Hardingham. What was said to the rose that made it open was said to me here in my chest. Rumi. The Rose Lullaby. One night reviled, before break of morn, amid the roses wild, all tangled in thorns, the shadow and the child together were born. The bright sun did spin, the moon swallowed day, when one her dear twin forever did slay. Part 1. Amid the Roses Wild. 1. Aurora. Winter seemed to come early in 1313, the year Aurora was born. For days that July, a mass of damp white flakes clung to treetops and roofs like snow. Some thought perhaps it was the North Fairy's doing. They were wrong. In her day, which was a very long time ago indeed, the North Fairy had been known for wreaking havoc on the skies whenever she lost one of her infamous chess games. But she had died many decades before our story begins, mysteriously murdered in her own home. That's why the White Throne, carved entirely from the tusks of narwhals, is now called the Red Throne. It's covered in her blood. Aurora knows the stories well. She's read the entire 313-book collection of fairy histories in her grand library. Princesses have a great deal of time on their hands, after all. Especially princesses like Aurora, who have no sense of touch and no voice. These were tithes from her just months after her birth. But it wasn't snow that came down that summer, for it didn't melt, and it wasn't any fairies doing either. As everyone who was alive then and remains alive today remembers vividly, the ashes that rained over heads and homes and whole towns across the kingdom of Deluce had one very distinct quality, the acrid scent of spindlefire, wet wool, wood smoke, burning hair. 2. Isabel. Mud, murk, dankness and blackness, and bogland and fog, so thick it entered the folds of the mind. This was Isabel's world as a child. Gradually, though, she discovered darkness was not an absence of light, but a living thing, an infinitely tangible substance to roll around in and dig into. She began to fall in love with that darkness, exploring its wells of sounds and stirs. The palace was full of dim corners where the king's unwanted daughter could play. The whole estate sits right on a cliff above the mouth of the Strait of Sorrow, whose tide pulls clouds to shore and traps them there, churning and unquenchable. This makes the air briny. It has the vague taste of sardines and the softness of moss. The floors are always slick with moisture. The walls bright, dusted with salt. Over time, Isby learned the feel of every dent in these walls. Every variety of squeak and cry from the floor formed a language. Don't enter. Turn right. Someone was just in here. Or, you are alone. You see, she was blinded at the age of 2, the very day of her half-sister Aurora's christening. Some people consider it a problem, or even a curse, to be forever trapped in darkness. But Isabel no longer minds the dark. Light, too, can be a curse. It can illuminate things no one should ever have to witness. 3. Aurora. The double doors to the library fly open. Aurora quickly closes the Song of Rowan and tucks it beneath her chair cushion as Isby tramples in, shaking snow off her boots. Her knotty chestnut hair is in its usual disarray, her plain blue and white dress torn in at least 2 places. Aurora, on the other hand, believes that a princess is meant to look the part at all times, even if she is merely hiding out alone in her library reading romances. Today, for instance, she is wearing a burgundy underdress, with an overdress featuring a complex pattern of golden birds and deep green vines. She even wears a small hennin atop her head, with a long veil trailing behind it. "Did Rowan take full advantage of his stony love yet?" Isby asks with a smirk, her eyes fixed on an invisible spot in the distance. She doesn't have to be able to see to guess. This isn't the first time Aurora has been caught in private, agonized rapture over the tale of Rowan and his true love, Umberline, who was turned to stone until 1,000 crows came down and pecked her free. Aurora herself is still waiting to be released in a way. Not from stone, of course, but from the long, silent hours of wandering, trapped in a world where she cannot speak and cannot feel. Will she find true love with Prince Philip of Arben? Even now he and his brother are galloping toward the palace. "Ah, good. Some air. That's what this room needs." Isby has popped open the secret pane in a stained glass window, allowing delicate flurries to flutter in. Beyond the glass, the famous Delusian cliffs plummet down to the Strait of Sorrow, where Aurora can imagine the snow dissolving like sugar into tea. Isby throws herself onto the floor by Aurora's feet, as she is wont to do. Aurora's half-sister is as extreme with her very pale skin and very dark hair as Aurora is soft with her warm complexion and blonde waves. They are like night and day, or winter and summer. And like both examples, one could simply not exist without the other. The princess bends down and takes her sister's hand, tapping into her palm, using the secret language they've been evolving and deepening since early childhood. "Soon it will be Philip, and not Rowan, who occupies my time and your filthy imagination." Occasionally, Isby misses a word here or there, but it's rare. Princesses and their bastard half-siblings have plenty of time to perfect such things. The girls even have a symbol for the name Rowan, the tap for an R and then the pressure sequence that means handsome. This is how Aurora connotes all the heroes in her stories, the letter of his name followed by an adjective: handsome, charming, loyal, strong. Isby flashes her big, jagged, unself-conscious smile at Aurora. "True." Then her face falls. "I'll have to rely on my imagination, since I'm sure you'll no longer have any time to fill me in on the details." Aurora squeezes her hand. "No, I'll miss you every moment I'm with him," she taps. "Hopefully not every moment," Isby grins again. Then she lets out a big sigh. "No reason for the dramatic sighs. Everything will be normal," Aurora taps. "Well then," Isby announces, "I was going to share some gossip. I just overheard that Prince Philip and his younger brother Edward were spotted on the road 2 days ago at Tristesse Pass, along with their retinue, which means they should be arriving sooner than we thought, most likely by tonight, in time for your birthday." Aurora gasps a sound that's almost inaudible. Her entire body buzzes with all the hectic energy of a chicken coop. Her planned marriage to Prince Philip is supposed to cement an important alliance between the kingdoms of Deluce and Arben. Deluce has wealth, Arben has military. The idea is that together they can stop the threat of the last living fairy queen, Malfleur. If the rumors are true, that is. Word has it Malfleur has been building up her army using secret techniques unknown to the rest of the world, in addition to practicing levels of magic not seen among the Fae in centuries. Just thinking about it gives Aurora a chill. Lamort is the only kingdom ruled by a fairy anymore. It used to be that all the positions of power were held by the Fae, but that was long ago. Aurora's grandfather was part of the wave of human monarchs pushing the Fae out, even as the fairies' magic waned. Now most of Deluce's aristocracy is human, though a fairy duchess or baron remains here and there. And while the Fae allow females to govern alone, they pretty much have to, since female fairies generally outlive male fairies by many decades. Humans do not. A human princess must marry to become a queen. Aurora knows how important her upcoming wedding really is to the safety of her kingdom. But that doesn't mean she can't secretly hope that it will be more than tactical, that the prince will be her true love, and with that love, her whole life will change. That, like Umberline from the story, she will finally be freed. The veil on Aurora's Henin dances wildly in the open air. Because of her lack of touch, she doesn't feel pain. So while the princess can tell that it's very cold out, the chill doesn't really bother her. It's just there. A dim awareness, like a heartbeat. It's always windy up on the palace wall walks, where she and Isby have come to look out for the banners of the approaching princes and their retinue. Through the crenellated parapet, Aurora can see the vast expanse of the royal village and the lands to the south and west sides, the mouth of the strait to the northeast, all covered in the soft drape of evening. It's especially blustery at this time of year and this time of day, when the sun has worn down to a crimson paper cut slicing sea from sky. The wind is helpful, anyway, to her sister. It carries information, sounds and smells that tell her who is coming and how high the tides are, what will be served for dinner, and which of the soldiers guarding the front gates have bedded which of the housemaids. Tonight, Isby's face is alive with curiosity, and for what is probably the millionth time, Aurora wishes her sister could see herself, even for an instant. That she could witness the way joy and sadness write themselves so boldly in her expressions, how uncontained her emotions seem. As different as they are, Isby's features hard and wild and pale next to Aurora's rosiness, her sun-colored hair and gentle curves, Aurora likes to believe that something invisible, something deep inside each of them, is connected, forged from the same fire. Isby races ahead along the wall walk, which is lit by torches ensconced in the iron brackets atop the 7 cupola-covered drum towers. Her form flickers between light and shadow as she passes by each of the parapet's teeth. She is already climbing the stones of the southeast tower, the King's Tower, which is also the best vantage point, by the time Aurora reaches the wide southern wall. Aurora wants to call for Isby to wait, but of course she can't. She just hopes they won't get caught sneaking around up here. 4 years ago, the plague killed both of her parents, King Henri and Queen Amélie. Since then, the council's role has grown from keeping careful watch to issuing suffocating rules, and it's even worse lately. Because Aurora's 16th birthday is tomorrow, and the wedding to Philip will soon follow, the council has essentially kept her under lock and key within the lonely palace walls, even though Isby is completely free to roam the ample grounds, romp through the royal forest, ride horses, snack on random pickings from the lower kitchen, and pretty much do anything she pleases. Everyone acts as if Aurora might collapse under a stray breeze, since she paid the tithe of touch as a child. She is constantly in danger of getting hurt and not realizing it. And it's true, she has burned herself too many times to be allowed in the kitchens or too close to the fire. She has embarrassing scars on her knees from various tumbles as a child that led to scratches that bled for hours before she noticed them. Following Isby's disappearing form, Aurora hurries to the King's Tower and tries to get a foothold in the still wet stone. Before she gets very far, the familiar voices of the council members float over her head. The King's Tower holds one of their meeting rooms, and with its jutting, thinly paned oriel windows, it is one of the easiest rooms to spy on, if you happen to be on the roof. Aurora pauses, listening to what sounds like a heated exchange. It's very rare for the council to be meeting this late, particularly when such important guests are expected at any moment. She tucks her dress and robes around her legs and crouches just beneath the oriel, peering in.
"They were supporters of Malfleur, I'm sure of it," one of the men is saying. Another scoffs. "Nothing but peasants and petty thieves. A horrible accident, and that is all." "It's not the time to analyze the attack. We are in a state of emergency," cries another, slamming down hard on a table.
A horrible accident? Attack? A state of emergency? What could possibly have happened? She inches slightly closer to the base of the window, straining to hear.
This is more than an attack. This is a political maneuver. It's a diplomatic crisis.
He's right. It's an act of war. This has to be Malfleur's doing. And without Arbin on our side, we are sunk. Arbin still needs us as much as we need them. Their royal coffers are dry. We know that. Their precious war overseas has seen to that.
Before we come to any conclusions, we must reconcile ourselves to the murder of the two princes and decide upon swift and immediate action.
At this, Aurora loses her grip and falls several feet to the damp stone floor of the wall walk. The fall doesn't hurt, of course, but the news rings loud and harsh in her ears. The murder of the two princes. It cannot be true. Philip is no longer coming to marry her. He and his brother Edward are dead. She must have misunderstood. She needs to go in there and confront them, find out the truth. But even as she thinks that, she realizes how silly it sounds. Aurora, confronting the council. It's unheard of. In the past, she's made vain attempts to write her thoughts down with ink on vellum, copying the beautiful script found in the book she loves to read. But the council members have only responded with blank, befuddled stares. In fact, most of them are illiterate and find it simply unimaginable that a woman could have taught herself to both read and write. The murder of the two princes. The words keep repeating themselves, tumbling over one another in her mind, even as she scrambles up the tower toward her sister. She wishes once again that she could call out to Isby. But with no voice, she is left to climb, higher this time, desperate to find her, to convey what she's heard. The dome is slick and cold. She reaches the top of the tower and clings to the curved roof, inching her way toward the outer-facing side. She thinks she sees Isby just around the... A gust of wind blows Aurora's veil into her face. As she tries to shake it free, she senses her shoe has become heavy. It must have soaked up some of the unmelted snow, which means her foot slips. She gasps, her balance giving way, then flails, losing her grip with one hand. Panic flies through her lungs, leaving her mouth in a silent scream. The murder of the two princes, the wind sings back to her, and she knows. She is going to fall. A shout pierces the darkness. Isby's face, torch lit, hovers above her. She has firmly caught Aurora's sleeve and yanked her back against the tower.
Aurora, I heard you. I'm here.
Aurora's pulse races in her throat. She is shaking, marveling at her sister's ability to hear even the slightest skid of shoe against ice. Slowly they move to safety, one chapped hand before the other, until they are just above the wall walk, where Isby leaps down first and reaches up to assist Aurora, whose heart is still pounding so powerfully she fears she may faint. But as her dizziness clears, all she can think is what she must communicate to Isby. The princes, both of them, murdered.
Oi, what are you doing up here?
Two night guards are approaching. Aurora frantically tries to grab Isby's hand, but the guards rush them from either side and yank them apart.
Told you to stay off here, one guard grumbles.
Let us go,
Isby cries as they are both dragged roughly down the steps.
Escaped your cage again, eh?
Says the other to Aurora. She's thankful that Isby can't see the sneer on his pocked face. Isby juts out her chin.
We were just trying to...
That's about enough of that,
one growls as they haul the girls through a passageway, up another set of stairs and into the king's tower proper, where they are presented before the 12 gathered councilmen and women.
Sorry to barge in, but we caught 'em climbing the towers again. Princess almost took a bad drop,
the older and fatter of the guards says.
This one was scampering up and down like a goat.
Before Aurora can so much as shake her head in protest, Isby clears her throat, squeezing Aurora's hand tight.
He's right. It was all my fault, not Aurora's.
Meanwhile, Jules de Villeroy, the Chancellor, tugs at his collar.
This is a most, most inopportune moment.
Aurora desperately taps into Isby's hand. The prince is dead. Philip's dead. She can't tell if her sister has registered the message. Old hot-headed Humphrey bangs his fist on the arm of his chair.
Damn it! Endangering the princess at a time like this. I've had enough. All of our plans, the whole alliance, up in smoke in a moment if something were to...
He cuts himself off and takes a breath.
If we don't handle that one, he finishes, pointing fiercely at Isby, then I, personally, will.
Aurora looks nervously around the room at the council. Two men and two women. The men all have bare, protruding foreheads, the style of the time, though Aurora can't understand why, and wear high collars and deep frowns. The women, both financial attendants, look as shriveled as the pickled fish Aurora has watched servants eating in the kitchen. She can't remember a time when these women were young. These are the men and women who have, over the past 4 years, become the unwanted surrogate caretakers for her and Isby. She knows none of them has any true affection for her. She is a mere item to be bartered. It's even worse for Isby, of course. She is no princess, and she will be 18 soon. So far, despite the council's best attempts, no one has been interested in marrying the dead king's blind bastard daughter. Lord Ferdinand pushes his chair back from the table. Aurora can't help but notice that the corner of the rotund man's red robe is stained with either mud or gravy. More likely the latter, given how little he's known to venture past the castle walls.
With the permission of my fellow councilman, Ferdinand says, I see it fit we pursue our original plans regarding Isabel immediately.
Plans? Isby asks, as Aurora's heart starts to beat faster.
You are to be sent to a convent in the district of Isley, says one of the stern old clerics at the back of the room.
But for how long? Isby croaks.
For the remainder of your life, says the cleric.
No! Isby tries to lunge forward. However, one of the guards keeps his fat hand around her arm, holding her back. Aurora feels like she's been strangled. Isby, leaving. Forever. It's too much. Her knees are beginning to give out. Her sister shouldn't have said anything. She shouldn't have opened her big mouth, trying to be brave, trying to protect Aurora like always. Look where it's gotten her now. Maximilian, one of the younger members and perhaps the kindest of the council, despite being the chief of military, nods.
We were going to wait until after the wedding, but we might as well make haste. Aurora's safety and protection are of utmost importance.
Aurora doesn't know whether to be furious or devastated or simply afraid. Isolée lies at the southernmost point of Deleuze, near the border of Corain. That's miles and miles from the palace. She fumbles for Isby's hand again, but her sister pulls away.
Why? She blurts out. Why are we to be parted if the wedding is no longer happening?
So her palm did understand Aurora's hasty message. Maximilian frowns.
I can see you have been listening in where you were not invited.
Nevertheless, he turns to Aurora. You both may as well know that Princes Philip and Edward of Arban are dead.
Aurora's heart plummets into her stomach like a bucket dropped down a well. Hearing it announced so bluntly is even harder the second time.
I ask again, Isby says, jutting out her chin. How will Aurora marry if the two princes of Arban are dead?
Luckily, another council member replies, there is a third.
4. Isabel. If human bodies had the firepower of cannons, Isby is sure her head would have shot off and exploded, scattering burning black ash all over the council. Aurora has read and described to her the exact mechanics of every type of weapon in Deleuze's royal arsenal, and Isby often entertains herself by imagining putting them to use. Her fingertips graze the tapestries and portraits that line the walls as she stomps down the stone corridors, knocking over the Hercules vase in her rush, its nose worn down from years of her touching it. The piece is worth more than the dowry of 7 duchesses. She hears it shatter. Good. Over a century ago, this whole castle was actually the Fairy Queen Malfleur's own childhood home. She lived in it with her twin, Belle Coeur, otherwise known as the Night Fairy. That was before Malfleur killed the Night Fairy and was assigned rule over the La Morte territories. There's even a popular children's lullaby based on the story, but now ornate columns, thick rugs, and over-pungent displays of flowers hide any trace of the palace's history, which becomes more like myth every day. Isby doesn't even let Aurora catch up to her as she traipses downstairs to her quarters in one of the western wings, not bothering to skip over the creaking seventh stair. She needs to be alone. She needs to think. And for once, Aurora's advice, her calm wisdom, simply won't help. Isby knows that it's not Aurora's fault. It's not her fault that she's the only heir to the throne of Deleuze. It's not her fault the kingdom could be on the verge of war. And it's not her fault she's so beautiful and well-behaved and perfect. Aurora is all light. She is fresh, fluffed cream and the smell of a spring bulb's first shoots pricking up through the earth, while Isby has always been the expendable one, all anger and elbow, odd as a goose's honk. For years, the council has treated her no better than a glorified servant. Any kindness she has received has been at Aurora's insistence. Isby is the troublemaker, good for nothing except to serve as a companion for her younger sister, and now apparently not even good for that. The truth that Isby is simply no longer needed, by Aurora or by anyone, cuts into her, savage as claws. She shoves open her door, and it slams into the wall with a terrible bang. It takes her a second to realize from the shift of heat and shadow, from the intake of breath, that someone is already waiting for her in the room.
"Think this here pillow is enough tassels?"
Gilbert, one of the stable boys and Isby's oldest friend, shifts his legs on her bed, rustling her downy coverlet. She can smell the mud on his boots and the equine musk ever present in his hands and hair.
"Enough to strangle all 12 council members with?" she replies. "Unfortunately, no, Gil. I doubt there's enough frill in this entire castle to knot around their thick necks."
"Bad night."
"To say the least."
"What is it?" Her bed exhales as he sits up. The few pieces of furniture in her bedroom have all learned to speak to her of movements, in creaks and whooshes and groans, in ticks and aspirations. While Gil is, of course, technically not allowed in her room, not merely because he's the son of the palace horse farrier, but also because he's a boy, he has nonetheless entered and exited these chambers for years without anyone knowing it, by way of a lilac trellis underneath her window.
"Isby," Gil presses, "just tell me."
"I'm leaving," she spits. For weeks, months even, she's been agonizing about what will happen to her when Aurora marries. She loathes the fact that her fate is so dependent on her younger, more beautiful sisters. The way all her choices, when it comes down to it, are invisibly tethered to Aurora's. No matter how much she loves her sister, no matter how many years of their childhood they spent clambering up and down the winding passageway connecting their bedrooms, some part of her has always wished that for just one moment she could find out what her life would be like if Aurora weren't around. Now she will know, and she hates herself for that terrible, shameful wish.
"What? You can't leave. I don't understand. Where are you going?"
He touches her arm, his hand familiar as Aurora's, is as rough as hers is delicate, a deep, rain-worn crease cutting diagonally across his calloused palm. She swallows hard. She can barely stand to explain what just happened. It's so mortifying. She feels hollowed out. Not only are they sending her away, but it has always been their plan. She's disposable. A pomme sauvage. A crab apple barely hanging on to the tree. Not sweet enough to eat, sour and unwanted, even before it falls to the earth to rot. "The council wants to send me to a convent in Isolay.
Apparently, they were always intending it. But tonight we got in trouble, and the princes of Arbin, two of them anyway, were murdered. And Aurora and I were caught spying, and now..." She takes a breath, steadying her voice.
"Now I'm to depart at dawn."
Gil barks out a laugh.
Horrified, Isby shoves him away. This isn't funny. It's my life. She marches miserably to her trunk and throws open the lid. Gil comes up behind her. Well, this is perhaps perfect then.
Yes, it's...
Wait. What? She turns. I'm leaving the palace too, Gil says. Automatically, she reaches up and places her hands on his cheeks, feeling the dimples and familiar smile, the honesty, the Gilbertness of him. It's a habit that started many years ago with her half-sister. Isby would touch her face to try and read the emotions there, since Aurora has no voice to betray the feeling behind her words. It was Isby's way of staying as connected as possible to Aurora, and then it became so second nature that she began to try it out on Gilbert too. He never refused.
You're not joking, she says now, both feeling and hearing his seriousness.
No, and it isn't funny, actually. His jaw clicks softly. My brother's wife died last month, in childbirth. I only just found out. Lost the baby, too. Rule is, well, you can imagine.
I'm, she fumbles, taken aback. I'm very sorry. Isby hasn't seen Gil's older brother in many years, and never knew Rule's wife. To her knowledge, Gil never met her either.
Gil clears his throat. Anyway, he didn't send for me. You know Rule. He wouldn't do that, too proud. But a messenger let it slip. He could use my help at the farm, what with the two young ones. He isn't too many miles south of here.
Isby nods. She remembers when Rule left to take over a farm in one of the vast fairy-owned fiefs farther inland. He had to pay several tithes of luck to a fairy baron for it.
He'll take us both in, I'm sure, Gil goes on.
Needs all the help he can get, I'd think.
I wasn't certain if I should go. That is, I didn't want to leave. But now, see? You wouldn't have to go to Isolée. You could just come with me.
Isby doesn't know what to say, only that her face feels as though it has been splashed by a pot of scalding water. Embarrassment and gratitude fight each other for space inside her chest. She has no idea what farm life is really like, but it must be better than life in a convent. At any rate, life there with Gil would be immeasurably better than being alone. Besides, Gil goes on, just picturing you at a convent is hilarious. Girl like you wouldn't last till the first sundown.
A girl like me? Wild, big mouth, says whatever she pleases.
Humph. She's not sure if it's a compliment or an insult, but she lets the point drop, instead crouching down to cram dresses and sheets into her trunk. She must keep her hands and mouth busy, otherwise who knows what she might be tempted to do. Muzz up Gil's hair, or kiss him, or...
Poor Rule, she says instead, attempting to distract herself from the fact that she is preparing to leave her home, and Aurora, forever.
I'm sure there's many a country girl waiting in line to be his next wife, though.
Everyone used to say he was tall, dark-haired and handsome, even when they were all kids.
Perhaps, she adds, nudging Gil with her shoulder, he'll have extras lined up for you as well. Some delightful farmer's daughter for a wife. A nice girl who always says exactly the right thing.
The idea brings her a mix of happiness for Gil and something else, too. Jealousy, maybe. Though it shouldn't. She knows that. Still, she wonders whether in moments like this he ever thinks back to that day, about 3 years ago, the day she was wading in the tiny stream just past the cattle pastures. Isby had borrowed Freckles again, the frisky young mare few others had the patience to ride, for one of her expeditions to spy on the royal military. These rides very often ended with Freckles bucking Isby into the thick mud at pasture's end. The council did not condone this behaviour, of course, said she'd likely die someday for taking such risks, but for Isby it became a game, trying to figure out where she'd landed and how to get back. Since she had grown up without sight, Isby has rarely known the pleasure of running freely through field or forest. It's too dangerous, the world rushes up at her, random and disordered. But on the back of a horse, she can experience the thrill of speed, of the air racing through her hair, of her lungs heaving as the animal becomes her legs and her eyes.
And she has never cared about the odd bruises and scrapes from falling or fumbling her way home. These are simply the world's way of proving its own existence, the souvenirs of a life
actually lived. On this particular occasion, Gil had found her doing her best to wrench the mud from her garments in the stream's eddies. In late spring, when the sun is hot, the stream flows over a low ledge, creating a nice current below. She and Aurora fondly call this spot the waterfall, even though the drop is only a few feet. Sometimes they also call it Nose Rock, due to the boulder at the base of the ledge that resembles a man's face with, well, a very large nose. Gil had scolded her for riding alone, and to defend herself, Isby began an enactment of the military exercises she'd learned from spying, or at least what she presumed them to be, based on the shouted commands she'd overheard, the hollers of the soldiers, the clang of swords, and the shuffle of hooves. The more Gil laughed at her attempts, the more determined Isby became to prove she'd truly learned how to fight. Her demonstration easefully transformed into a water war, and she remembers the exact moment she fell against Gil in the stream, and his hand became entangled in her long, loose hair, and the mossy, mineral scent of the water mingled with the damp touch of his body against hers, his laughter slipping away on the wind as their lips met. The kiss had been both surprising and seamless, both endless and somehow fleeting. His lips were warm and soft, so unlike the other, more calloused parts of him she was used to. His tongue was there, communicating with her own in a foreign language, and there was so much to say with just their bodies, with just their lips. But then he'd pulled back, their first ever awkward moment. "We shouldn't," he'd said. Something like that. She couldn't understand what he meant, why he said it. Why he didn't want to keep on doing what they had been doing for hours, for days, maybe forever. And then, with a sudden and terrible weight, she knew. Of course she knew. Isby was not beautiful. Not like other girls. Certainly not like Aurora. Even without being able to see her the way others did, Isby knew how gorgeous Aurora was, from the way she moved, the way she smelled, the way people inhaled abruptly when they saw her. The way men spoke about her in whispers and murmurs they thought no one else could hear. No, Isby was different. Awkward and tall for a girl, with messy dark hair that never lay flat, a pointy nose and hard cheekbones and two big eyes. Gil didn't see her that way. He didn't want those other things from her, the things boys want from beautiful girls. After that day, Isby had become as firm and hard as Nose Rock. Wild and spiked and merciless, as a morning star club. Brave and bold and quick, too quick to let feelings of doubt or embarrassment about her appearance ever catch up to her again. She doesn't need to be beautiful, and she doesn't need love. She can live without it. But now her comment lingers uncomfortably in the air between them. Gil clears his throat. "I shall prepare us two horses. We'll ride just before dawn." "Gil?" she asks, as he stands to leave. "Is?" She turns her face away from his, feeling exposed. "Thank you." And then he is shoving her window open, and with a gust of cold air, he is gone. Isby is still packing when a rustling in the secret passageway announces Aurora's approach. A second later, the tapestry swishes open, and Aurora's slippers pat across the room. She kneels next to Isby, and their elbows bump. Even though Isby's swimming in a sea of confused and contradictory feelings, she is just as aware as ever of her sister's fragility. It's Isby's job, as it has always been, to be strong for Aurora. Even if, in this moment, Aurora can't be strong for her. Aurora takes her hand and begins to tap. "I didn't need you to stand up for me. You shouldn't have..." Isby can feel the pent-up frustration through the tips of Aurora's fingers. "Maybe if you had kept quiet, you wouldn't have to go." "Aurora, that's silly. Even if I hadn't said a thing, they would still be sending me away. I'm not needed here anymore. You're getting married. I no longer have a use. It's a wonder they didn't send me sooner." "It's not fair. I'm not a child, and I should have a choice. It's not up to you." "It's not up to either of us. It's up to the council. She feels a little calmer when she thinks of Gilbert's promise to help. Maybe once Aurora is settled with her new prince, she can be reunited with her sister. Besides, I'm not going to the nunnery, so you needn't worry.
What?
I'm not going. I'm running away.
But I'll still be here, lonely and miserable.
Isby tries to ignore the mild sting in her words.
You won't be lonely. You're marrying a prince. I'm the one being kicked out of our home. I'm sorry if I can't say I pity you. Please don't be jealous of me, Isby. You know how much I need you. We need each other.
Jealous, she snorts. Jealous of the princess who can't speak or feel, who's forced into a marriage with a prince she's never met. As if I'd want my life to be anything like yours, she blurts out. She can feel from the tension in Aurora's body that she has hurt her sister. Slowly, Aurora taps.
In that case, maybe it is for the best that you're leaving.
She doesn't mean it. Isby knows. She's just offended. She's just worried and upset about everything that's happened in the past few hours. But still, Isby yanks her hand away, her sharp cruelty. Without their hand-to-hand connection, her sister can't communicate at all. She's trapped in her own silence. Well, she'd better get used to it.
Please just leave. I need to be alone.
The words burn her throat, and as soon as her sister swishes through the tapestry and her distressed footsteps fade from the secret corridor, Isby slumps down onto her plush bed, a flood of dread and sadness pushing up against her on all sides, threatening to drown her. She rolls over, pushing her face into a pillow. Its fresh, linen-y smell only makes the pain welling up inside her worse. How many times has Aurora insisted on Isby's comfort, even at the expense of her own? How often has Isby tended to Aurora's scrapes and cuts and bee stings? Not because they hurt her, but precisely because they didn't. Sometimes Isby could swear she felt the pain that her sister could not, held it for her in case that was how pain worked and someone had to bear it. How many mornings did they wake side by side, having stayed up too late, telling each other stories? How many games and jokes and codes did they create, not to mention an entire secret language of hand taps, building a world that was all their own, an impenetrable fortress belonging just to them? Isby longs even now to crawl up the secret passageway to Aurora's room and apologize, to get into her bed and refuse to let go of her, refuse to be parted. But it's an impossible wish. Her life until now has been a lie, an indulgence, and the horrible suspicion that Aurora pities her, that on some level maybe she wants Isby out of her way, is what gives her the resolve she needs at last. Isby would always rather face the truth, even if it crushes her. When she hears the pebble against her window several hours later, she doesn't hesitate. If she turned back now and ran to apologize to Aurora, she might lose her nerve. So she walks toward the wind blowing her open shutters back and forth. Night has a very different smell from day. It is purer, sweeter somehow. In the night, there are no boundaries between herself and the world around her. She is equal to it. Isby heaves her trunk onto the windowsill and, when Gil calls softly up to her, drops it into his waiting arms, fleeing her room, and her sister and her home, and her life up until now. As the cold air embraces her, and she grips the lilac trellis for the last time, she could swear her own palm tingles, as though from a simple long and short pinky tap. Goodbye.
5. Aurora. Aurora is startled from fitful sleep by a loud rustling of feathers and a voice.
"Evening, caged bird," it says.
She opens her eyes and scans the room. The door is closed. A fire mellows in the hearth. Perhaps one of her maids came in to stoke it. That must have been the noise. Or maybe she was dreaming. She leans back against the pillow. Her eyes drift closed again.
"Any pastry?" "Better yet, mouse's head."
This time Aurora sits up with a start. On her window ledge stands a small, smoke-black starling, silhouetted by the moonlight. Its tiny dark eyes shine, and it cocks its head as though curious or hungry. She must have left her window open a crack, since the cold doesn't bother her. She sometimes forgets to worry about it. The bird in the window is watching her. It's almost as if the bird was the one to speak. But that's old magic. Impossible magic. Then, as she watches, the bird opens its mouth.
Me? What?
Each of the words a separate call.
What is me?
Aurora's chest tenses. A talking bird. Like something from one of her tales. She throws back the covers and steps cautiously toward the window. Around the bird's ankle is a fine metal brace, and if she's not mistaken, it bears a familiar image, a thorny ring surrounding a small crow, the crest of Malfleur. Aurora stares in awe. People say that unlike most fairies, Queen Malfleur still knows how to wield magic of great power and influence, has made a special study of it all her life, which has been long. She reigns over the scattered territories of disgruntled and largely disorganized citizens in the remote Lamorte Mountains. And Deluce has little to no traffic with Lamorte. So there's not much evidence to prove whether the rumors of the Queen's gifts of magic are true. In fact, Deluce has issued many trade sanctions against them and has repeatedly taxed all passage between the two kingdoms in an effort to discourage the unhappy, unhealthy, and often uncivilized people of Lamorte from crossing over to the lands of their far wealthier neighbors. Aurora has always assumed Malfleur's skill and magic had been vastly exaggerated throughout the years, more myth than truth to it. But studying the bird now, Aurora realizes that in fact the rumors about Malfleur's powers may have been accurate all along. If the Fairy Queen can make birds speak, what else can she do? And why has the bird come here? Aurora shivers again, trying to picture the Fairy Queen with a dramatic white scar that supposedly crosses her left eyelid. The bird flutters its wings.
Me, freak? Me, fiction?
Aurora shakes her head. No.
What is me?
The bird asks, and she cannot tell if the words are a taunt or a test or a sincere question.
Vermin? Wonder. Failed experiment. Or success?
She shakes her head again.
Magic in guts. Magic inside. Words inside. Like dust. Eating dust. Like fire. Me? Alone. Alone.
The bird says. Its voice is cold as iron, and she can't tell whether it knows what it's saying, whether it's asking for help.
Cat got your tongue?
The bird caws.
Cat got your tongue?
Aurora shakes her head a third time.
No words, human.
The starling caws again, and it sounds like a harsh laugh.
Like scarecrow.
At this, Aurora loses patience and shoos the bird out of the window with a hard wave at the back of her hand. The bird cries once more, fluttering back and taunting her with a final, mocking word.
Useless!
Then it's winging away into the night. As soon as it's gone, Aurora closes her shutters quickly, tears pricking at her eyes, mortification stinging her cheeks. Is she losing her mind? Or did a starling really just speak to her, and not just speak, but tease, call her useless, and compare her to a scarecrow? She gets back into bed, either to sleep and dream or else to wake up from this eerie nightmare. But neither happens. Instead, she lies awake, the starling's words lingering in her ears. Useless. She sits up and pushes back the covers. She goes to the hearth and lights a lantern, then wraps herself in her robe and hurries into the secret passageway to Isby's room. She has to tell her about the bird. Maybe her sister can help her understand what it means. But when she flips open the tapestry, she sees wind rattling the open shutters. The fire is out. The room is empty. Isby has gone.
Aurora adjusts the heavy cloak around her shoulders and lifts her lantern higher as she steps into the thick, moon-bright snow, reminding herself why she's doing this. She forces herself to think of the talking bird. She will not be useless. She will not let Isby go. She has always needed her sister. Now, her sister needs her. She's not going to let her just run away like that. She'll find her, bring her back, fight for her to stay. Suspecting Gilbert's aid, the first thing she does is look for hoofprints, which are easy enough to find in the new fallen snow. She traces them past the stables and along the dark woods at the edge of the castle village. She passes the unruly thicket where she and Isby used to imagine that evil monsters dwelled at night, the branches twisted into an ornate latticework glistening with frost. The path of snow, Prince, leads her to the main southerly road, which first winds closer to the shores of the strait and then curves west, veering toward the vast expanse of land beyond the royal grounds. Peasants sleep later in winter, and the area appears deserted. She rapidly loses the meager set of hoofprints amid the mud and slush and chaos of horse tracks in the road, all silvered in a pre-dawn haze. She turns, half tempted to go back. Though she has only gone a few miles, she is as far as she's ever been from the castle. Sneaking away had in fact been easy, which gave Aurora an uneasy feeling. She's never considered simply leaving the palace before. Why would she? Now she's hoping that there will be so much to do in the morning in preparation for her birthday feast that it will take everyone a little while to realize that the princess herself has vanished, and the bastard sister too. She knows the council members will be quite busy doing their best to hide their fears about the prince's murders, while dispatching soldiers and guards to fortify the La Morte border. And if all goes well, she'll catch up to Isby by the afternoon, and they'll return safe and sound in time for the celebration. A horse-drawn cart clops toward her, and she moves to the side of the road as its giant wheels shoot mud up her ankles. She's partly hoping that its driver will stop and ask if she needs help, but she can't bring herself to wave him down, fearing she could be recognized and sent home as soon as the driver realizes she doesn't speak. She keeps her head down and continues walking. The road is disturbingly quiet. It occurs to Aurora that she really has very little sense of Deluce as a nation, of what it's really like to live here. She's been introduced to a variety of lords and ladies, dukes and duchesses, noblemen and noble fairies alike. But she's never once been invited to their homes, nor seen the great population of peasants at work. There's a rustle in the trees, and a bird darts out of the underbrush, flapping into the sky. Could it be the same starling? Worry blossoms inside her. There are so many things lurking in this world about which she knows so little. Magic that has the power to give birds speech, tensions that drive men to murder. Her heart races as though trying to speak for her, to tell her to stop, to turn back. This is no way to spend a 16th birthday, wandering alone. Another bird shrieks. A distant scream rings out. Maybe an owl. Or could it be the howl of a killer, covered in the stale blood of two princes, hungry for more? To be safe, Aurora steps off the road and into the soft thickness of the surrounding woods. Even with her lantern, it's dark. So dark. It's too late, or too early, for a girl, a princess, to be out alone. This was a mistake. She'll turn home and demand that the council send out a proper search party to discover Isby's whereabouts and bring her back. She'll find a way. Perhaps she can refuse to marry Prince William, the third and youngest son of the late King of Arben, until this one wish has been granted. Yes, that's what she'll do. She'll double back, sticking to the woods, which are speckled slightly with the last dregs of moonlight. But even upon turning around, pushing past underbrush and dodging the low-hanging branches of the trees, many still covered in snow, she begins to find herself disoriented. She'd been only a few feet from the road, hadn't she? But the road, of course, isn't lit, and so she can't quite tell. Better to chance bandits on the road than wolves in the forest. She moves a few feet in what she is sure must be the right direction, but only finds herself surrounded by more woods. Is this the royal forest? She begins to run, urgency pumping through her veins. Her dress tangles in roots and branches, and she hears a tear, but she doesn't care. She trips and falls onto her knees, dropping the lantern. The flame sputters out. With no way to relight it, she leaves it on the ground and gets up quickly, her fear spiking. She runs toward the road. The road isn't there. She turns around again and sees a glimmer of light. That must be it. The moon against a frozen puddle. Pulse hammering in her temples, she runs harder. She finds herself not beside the road at all, but near a cottage. Its windows are shuttered and completely covered in ivy. It must be one of the many old homes the royal families of the past used to summer in, ideal for hunting excursions. There are several of these throughout the royal forest, Aurora knows, many now long abandoned. Her father enjoyed hunting when he was young and decreed that all the deer in the forest be reserved for his use alone, but he apparently gave up the sport when he married her mother. Since then, the royal forest has become thick with foliage and busy with game that no one is allowed to hunt. This cottage is large but extremely humble in comparison to the palace, with only 2 levels and not a single tower. The light she thought she had seen is not the moon, but a strange cluster of fireflies huddled at the base of the front roof. As her eyes adjust, she can make out the shape of a small wooden swing tied with 2 ropes, lightly swaying in the wind. She has no idea where she is, or which of the several old summer homes this might be. But at this hour, an abandoned cottage seems far safer than the woods.
When the sun has fully risen, she'll resume her search for the road.
Ivy winds along the doorframe, and Aurora wonders when the door was last opened. After tugging and shoving, dust flying into her face, the heavy door eventually budges inward with a groan. Aurora glances over her shoulder into the whispering woods around her before entering the dark home. She leaves the door open a crack, hoping the faintest of outdoor light will penetrate the heavy blackness of the air within, and wishing she had just a small portion of Isby's bravery, her facility for moving about in the dark. "Think," she urges herself. Servants usually leave a lantern on a shelf just inside the door of every room. Her hands fumble along the inner walls until she trips and hears a clatter. A metal lantern. It must have been on the floor. She bends down and feels for the handle. Thankfully, there is an old candle inside and a tinderbox attached. Hurriedly, with trembling hands, she shakes a bit of dried kindling into the lid and removes the flint, then rubs the flint against the firestone, watching the faintest of sparks fly off. It takes several minutes before the kindling catches, a tiny winking orange ember, which she gathers toward her mouth and blows on until it becomes a small flame. Quickly, she uses the flame to light the candle before stomping it back out. It's the first time she has lit a candle like this in all her life. Normally, the servants keep fires burning in every room of the palace for all but a very few hours of the night, and it's far easier to light the lanterns using the already leaping half-flames. The dust in the air is thick. So thick she fears the air itself will somehow catch on fire. The house has clearly not been inhabited for many years, but feeling she has no better choice, she finds her way to the staircase and heads up, looking for something resembling a bedroom, where she can close the door and sleep the remaining hour or so until sunrise. At the top of the stairs, she enters the nearest room, and can see dimly that it's the children's nursery. An old doll sits in the window, a clock still ticking, is perched on the mantel, and 2 small beds line opposite walls. There's an open wardrobe, and inside it hang the forms of little girls' dresses, glimmering as though woven not of fabric but of precious metal. A whistle chimes, and Aurora nearly loses her breath before realizing the sound has come, oddly, from the clock. A tiny mechanical bird's face is popping in and out. It whistles once more, and then the bird's head retreats behind a little door below the 6. She's never seen anything like it before. She turns and notices something luminous in the corner of the room, a large golden wheel with spokes, bigger than one you might find on a horse-drawn cart. It looks like a glowing sun, and it's resting atop a low stand, also made of gold. Spilling from a small spool at its side is a long, shimmering thread. Aurora moves closer to inspect it. To her surprise, even in the candlelight, it appears the thread itself is made from gold. She examines a strange instrument from which the thread flows. It must be some sort of elaborate spindle, she realizes. She's never seen one, though she's read about them in books. Her parents always told her that spindles were instruments of evil, bad luck to be warded off at all costs. Since it was only one of many of their superstitions, she hadn't given it much thought before.